clinches, eliminations, triple plays. MLB is New York's hottest club right now, Jordan.
And we are going to talk about it. It's Wednesday. It's Baseball Barbercast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world brave enough to say that game-ending triple plays are bad for baseball. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and anything that keeps Shohei Ohtani down is a negative for the sport.
Yeah, if I was Donovan Solano catching the third out of that triple play at first base, I would have just trotted over and tagged Ohtani just to be safe. Because I still had the feeling like, they're still going to have Ohtani hit, right? I'll just make an exception. Be like, no, actually, if Ohtani is up as the game-tying run, you actually need four outs in this inning.
That was one of the more remarkable things that I've seen in a long time. We will certainly talk about that triple play last night that ended the Padres-Dodgers game. It is Wednesday morning, September 25th. And things are getting a little bit dicey here in the world of Major League Baseball. I was at Orioles Yankees last night. Jordan was at the Ohio Bowl.
The Ohio Cup. The Ohio Cup. There's a trophy and everything. Oh my gosh, it's a huge trophy.
You people are so funny, dude.
Yeah. That is me, people. I am Ohio now. How about that? Yes, Guardians beat the Reds. We're not going to talk about that as much. You saw the Orioles clinch a postseason spot. We are now down to just four spots remaining in the 2024 postseason field. As last night, the Astros won the AL West. The Padres clinched a postseason spot, winning their series opener with that triple play. And as I just mentioned, the Orioles defeating the Yankees in the Bronx. So a lot to get to. First half of the show, we are going to recap the Tuesday action because every night at this point is giving us some important stuff, let alone game-ending triple plays. And let's start there. Let's start with the final game of the night. Dodger Stadium, a series. We've had a lot of exciting Dodgers-Padres series over the last, 4 or 5 years or so. I will say, too, that whether it's in LA versus San Diego kind of brings a slightly different energy, right? We know that Petco Park has become this incredible home field advantage, this incredible atmosphere that this, with the team that, the late Peter Seidler coalesced and built and invested into, the fans have responded. And so when the Dodgers come to town, yes, there are, of course, Dodgers fans there, but that atmosphere is amazing. But I also love when the Padres now go to LA because it feels more like they feel more like the underdog, right? They feel like the team that's coming in trying to do the impossible, which is beat the Dodgers. And this week, this series this week, setting up so perfectly, three games at Dodger Stadium, three games back with a chance to win the division still. And the Padres got it done in this first night thanks to a marvelous performance from Michael King, who's really been their best starter all season, as much as I love Dylan Cease. And the Dodgers starting pitching was not good. Landon Knack is not someone I think this team is particularly excited about handing the ball to, but they don't have very many other options that can pitch multiple innings at this point. And so Landon Knack was not awesome. He wasn't horrific, but he was not great. And so even though the Dodgers went up early, the Padres were able to respond quickly. And then Michael King was cruising. And then we could obviously get to what happened at the end of the game, but anything else from the rest of the game?
Yeah, I mean, the Dodgers had the Padres and Michael King on the ropes in the first inning.
Yeah.
Ohtani leadoff double. Xander Bogaerts just yeets the throw of yeah. routine ground ball. Yeah. And the Dodgers are up 1-0 after two batters with Freddie Teoscar, Max Muncy, Will Smith coming up and a runner on second base. And they can't score another run. Michael King gets out of the inning. And then Jake Cronenworth, who, by the way, Jordan Schusterman, did not have an RBI in the month of September.
Whoa.
Before last night, his OPS was somewhere around 530 for the month.
Batting seven.
He rips.
Right. He's definitely plummeted down the lineup. Yep.
Yeah. But Jake Rakes, the Crone Zone. He hits a two-run homer in the second inning to put the Padres up. Later on in the game, he has an RBI double. Padres put up four runs, and they head to the ninth inning up 4-1. Brief shout out, friend of the show, Brent Honeywell, two scoreless, get to be on the playoff roster.
Kept it close, baby.
Really our first friend in the world of baseball.
Yeah, I don't think that's totally true, but definitely one of our longest tenured, and him and Kieran. I mean,
him
on.
And Kieran Lovegrove.
Let's give Kieran Lovegrove the shout out. But yeah, so Brent, and by the way, before that, let's just quickly mention the MLB debut of Edgardo Henriquez.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Which
Who is Edgardo Henriquez? He throws really hard.
Yeah.
Reliever for the Dodgers.
And this is someone who was not on any. He was an A-ball to start the season. And yeah, every team has hard throwers at this point. That's not uncommon. But every team also has maybe one or two that like figures out how to throw strikes in the bullpen every season. And those guys are capable of just zooming to the big leagues. And while he's not going to probably pitch more than one inning at a time every few days, he is the upside here was very apparent. I mean, not just the fastball, but the breaking stuff was ridiculous. So who knows if he's pitching leverage innings or not, but it's definitely a fun arm to add to this Dodgers pitching staff.
Sometimes these dudes turn into Orion Kirkering and are just immediately high leverage relievers. Yeah. And so it's worth a shot for the Dodgers bringing him up. Just quick story here. So I get home last night pretty late after the Yankees O's game, and I'm sitting on the couch watching the game. My dad's staying with me watching Padres Dodgers with my dad and my wife, and my wonderful wife looks at this guy throwing 100. I'm like, this guy, because I'm married now.
Yeah.
I'm like, this guy throws like 102, 103. And she's like, what's the fastest pitch anybody's ever thrown? I said, great question. 105.9, Aroldis Chapman. Mm-hmm. You know, next batter comes up and she just starts going, 106, 106. I'm like, I don't think Mr. Edgardo Henriquez is throwing 106 today.
He had some unverified 104s in like low A. I think he maxed at 102.2 in triple A. I mean, he throws very hard. Also, I'm sorry, he looks just like a skinnier version of Brewstar. Like, he looks like he could be Brewstar's brother.
Amazing.
And Brewstar pitched like two innings before. A little bit of a different arm action. I think he's getting a little bit more extension than Brewstar, but definitely a fun arm to add. So he goes scoreless inning.
I'm getting more extension than Brewstar. I just.
Yeah, that's true.
I love when you say unverified 104 as if it's like a climbing record or something, like you climbed Everest before there was like photo evidence or there was a wind aided 104.
What I mean by that, and that is very fair, is, and so maybe I'm disrespecting like the media folks in low A, whatever. But like we get like wild velocity numbers either in college or whatever. Until we get it on the TrackMan Hawkeye Statcast, it's like that's all I'm waiting for. And we got again, like I said, he's gonna throw 102. That's plenty hard. He doesn't have to throw 106. Sorry to Tamar. He can do just fine at 102.
There was a 130-year-old person in Kazakhstan in 1907, but if it's not on StatCast, Jordan doesn't care.
That's all right, exactly so correct.
We head to the ninth, and in comes Robert Suarez, Padres closer. And Robert Suarez is a very interesting character as we head into the postseason because he was dynamite for most of this year. He was meh last year, incredible in 2022. He did give up the home run to Bryce Harper in the NLCS. Way back when, was an all-star this year. Got paid.
I mean, this is a guy who made his debut in his 30s. He'd been over in Japan, and in 2022, it was like, wow, what an investment, even with some of the injuries. And then, I guess he opts out, and then he gets another deal, right? He had that first year, he got up to like, that additional $30, $40 million. And then last year, it was like, all right, what are we really looking at here? And then this year, he's one of the best closers in the league.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On July 4th, he had a 102 ERA. Okay.
Yeah.
That is so patriotic and also very low. Since then, okay, it has been worse. He has a 502 ERA since July 4th. And yet, even as the Padres have bolstered their bullpen with a bevy of no-nonsense MFers like Jason Adam and Tanner Scott and Brian Hoeing.
And Jeremiah Estrada, who was already there.
Estrada.
Yeah.
Suarez has remained in the ninth, even as he has looked, gotta say, shakier and shakier and shakier. His ERA is at 6.55 in the month of September. So he rolls out for the ninth inning, facing the bottom of the Dodgers order, and Will Smith leads it off with a single. And that moment, we've all seen it before. Dodgers, down, late, at home. You get the pitcher on the ropes, and it builds, and it tumbles, and it snowballs. Literally 2 days ago, we saw Ohtani and Betts go back-to-back against the Rockies. Yes, I know the Rockies are not the Padres, still. And so you start to see, given Suarez's recent past of struggling in the ninth inning, you can see a scenario in which this is just a devastating loss for the Padres. So Smith singles, Edmonds singles, first and third, Kike Hernandez broken bat single to put runners on first and second with nobody out, down two runs. Miguel Rojas is up, the nine hitter, with Shohei Ohtani lingering on deck.
And this is, and I have more Suarez thoughts. We'll circle back to those, but let's stay in the moment here. It's first and second, as you mentioned, with no outs. And nowadays, you don't often see the baseball internet screaming bunt. But this was the time that everyone was screaming bunt, including on the first pitch when Miguel Rojas shows bunt. And you think, okay, even if they are giving them an out, which after the game, Dave Roberts was like, after the first bunt attempt, which he, I guess, did not succeed in, first pitch was a strike and he did not bunt, or did not successfully put the bunt down. Then the bunt sign was off, and we know what happens next. We'll get to that in a second. Dave Roberts said after that, oh, well, the way that they were playing, we would have just been bunting into an out, which, like, yeah, that's the point. You're bunting into an out instead of hitting into three outs.
Or he means
two,
bunting.
Or even into two outs.
He means bunting into an out at third.
Okay, fair. Fire. That's fine. So, but again, we're weighing the risks here, right? And again, this is another thing about this. The revisionist history here is interesting, because while you could very much argue that Miguel Rojas should have been bunting under all circumstances, that's fine. What happens next is so improbable and ridiculous, and took the perfect batted ball to the perfect third baseman, that it's hard to get too angry at Miguel Rojas, in my opinion.
Rojas laces one to third. Manny Machado gathers, steps on third.
Who's still playing in. Still playing in. Yeah.
Right alongside next to the bag, right? There's a scenario here where if Rojas is not scoring a bunt, Machado is further back behind the bag and doesn't make this happen. Machado gathers, steps on third, flings it to second base. Jake Cronenworth makes the turn, fires to first, game-ending triple play. Now, another important element of this happening is Cronenworth, who has an abnormally outrageous throwing arm for a second baseman.
Yeah.
He was not just a college pitcher. Cronenworth threw on the mound as a pitcher in the minor leagues. He was up like 95, 96 on the mound.
Yep.
Most second basemen do not have that kind of arm. And if you watch this playback, the turn at second, for him to get that much on that throw, given his body position at the time, is the most outrageous part of this play for me.
There were two points made about this play that I appreciated from two of our favorite people. One was from our friend Clint Yates, pointing out that truly the footwork for Machado is marvelous. The fact that he is in front, in some ways it made it easier because he was closer to the base, but he wasn't literally in front of the base. Like, he had to turn around and rotate and perfectly step, in addition to fielding a ball that was hit at 97 miles an hour. This was a hard hit ball. This was not just like a basic ground ball. I mean, this was ripped right at him, and for him to be able to react and do that. And the other point that I believe Grant Brisby pointed out is, like, in a past generation, Kike is just taking out Cronenworth in an extreme fashion at second. And he didn't. He slid like a normal person. But there's probably a version of this, you know, 10, 20 years ago, where whoever's sliding into second here is doing something egregious. And probably for better, that is not what happened. So that is another, I think, valid point on this. I mean, again, it's I think, as Sarah Langs pointed out, only the third time that we've had a game-ending triple play in the last 30, 40 years. And in these circumstances, to clinch a postseason berth, to get them one game closer to the Dodgers in these NL West standings, it was unbelievable. And both calls, by the way, both broadcast calls were outstanding for Like, I thought Joe Davis nailed it. I thought Don Orsillo nailed it. I thought Jesse Agler on the radio nailed it. Like, it was, all of it was fantastic. I encourage watching all of those highlights.
Manny Machado threw this ball 85 miles an hour, which in the context of Edgardo Henriquez throwing 102, I understand maybe doesn't hit. But just that, like, how
accurately,
how?
Accurately, while turning around. It's not just the strength. It's the accuracy while spinning after having fielded a 97 mile an hour hot shot at your feet.
85. I tried to play baseball my entire life. Okay. So much time I dedicated to getting good at this sport. The fastest I ever threw a ball was 84. Okay. Ever. And I was just hopped up on caffeine that day. And here's Manny Machado just fling, floop, boop. Anyway, with this play, okay, and then they cut to Ohtani, who is on deck and just assumed he was going to hit. And it's like, that's wild. Padres win, clinch a postseason spot. Some, yes, Padres fans were mad at Dave Roberts for challenging the play, so that the Padres, I saw this in our replies. It was like that Dave Roberts didn't, like, no. Like, you challenge this play every single time, just in case. Yeah. You never know. It's nothing new.
He doesn't owe you anything. That doesn't make the highlight any worse. Like, sorry, no, you couldn't celebrate 30 seconds sooner.
Third postseason berth for the Padres in the last 5 years. Congratulations to them, to Mike Schilt, to Peter Seidler for what he built. Very impressive stuff. Two games left in this series. If the Padres win both of them,
yeah,
they control. They still control their own destiny right now. Yeah. And I just got to say, like, this Dodgers performance last night, it was not just Landon Knack being a less than ideal starting pitcher. This was the Dodgers playing a sloppy brand of baseball. They gave away a lot of free bases in the, I believe it was the fourth inning, where the Padres put a bunch of runs across. This is the type of performance we have seen the Dodgers give in NLDSs the past 2 years against Arizona and San Diego, where they got bounced early. Simple, right? This is what a Dodgers loss in October looks like, right? And
yeah,
that is what was so concerning, I think, about this. Now, look, do I think the Dodgers win one of the next 2 days and end up winning the division? Yes, I still do. That would be my pick. However, by going out and winning the first game, there are seeds of doubt sown into the brains of Dodgers fans all across Southern California.
Yeah. And so we got Jack Flaherty against Dylan Cease tonight, and then Thursday, Joe Musgrove against Walker Buehler. So, man, oh, man. I mean, that Thursday one could really set up to be quite something. But, yeah, I mean, Padres, there's so many amazing Padres things that have happened this year, and I'm excited to talk about more about them, you know, in the cup. But the Suarez thing is fascinating because they have all these other options. He's a very unique closer. I mean, he's throwing like 80% fastballs, and yeah, he's throwing hard. But if your command's a little bit off and if you're facing good hitters, they're going to hit the ball hard. And we saw that even with the bot. It was funny. You're like, here comes the bottom of the Dodgers lineup. It's Will Smith. It's like, right, well, it's a pretty good hitter. Like, that's, you know, you're not always going to have to deal with that at the bottom of the lineup. But to beat the Dodgers, I mean, that's what it's going to take. And so it took a triple play to get them out of that mess, and we'll see if they stick with Suarez. I feel like they will, but there could be other shaky moments there with him for sure.
Very quickly on Mets Braves, this game last night was pretty simple. Remember, the Mets went down to Atlanta with a 2-game lead on the wild card. Mets and the Diamondbacks technically had the same record, right? Mets needing 2 wins in Atlanta to clinch a postseason spot. Game one of this series, Luis Severino against Spencer Schwellenbach. And the result last night was simple. Spencer Schwellenbach freaking dealt 7 innings, allowing just 1 run, a solo shot from Mark Vientos. The Braves pounce on Severino in the middle innings and win 5-2-1. Besides the heartwarming pictures of the Acuña brothers hanging out and exchanging jerseys, was there anything from this game that stood out for you?
I mean, again, just pulling up the box, I didn't watch this game too closely, but 3 hits from Michael Harris is very encouraging to see. He's someone that, of course, you see stretches where he looks like one of the best players in baseball, and then you see stretches where he is immensely pitchable. I guess the other Braves news is that they will not be getting Austin Riley back this season. So that
just
is
quickly on Harris,
very important. Yep.
the Braves are so much better against left-handed pitching than right-handed pitching. They struggle against righties, and that was part of why the Mets wanted Severino to throw the first game of this series. And Harris, as one of the two lefties in this lineup, alongside Matt Olson, it was crucial that he showed up and performed last night. Very, very important for the Braves. So now the Braves are one game back in the wild card behind both the Diamondbacks and the Mets. The Diamondbacks are the team that I am the most worried about. They got boat raced by the San Francisco Giants, who are really giant killers right now.
Yeah,
they have been ruining the dreams of the Orioles and the Royals and whatever. They went 11-0 last night against the Diamondbacks, who are clinging to that final postseason spot. And it's a good reminder. There were two big reminders last night for me. And then we'll take a break. One is that if the Braves get in, they remain formidable. Their players are not going to panic. They have been to the postseason many times before. And that starting pitching is really good. Spencer Schwellenbach, who no one at Drew's Park last night had ever heard of before June, is freaking legit. I know that's an overstatement. I'm aware.
Yeah.
And the next two nights, they have Chris Sale and Max Fried. Okay. They sure do. Is dangerous. And then, other reminder last night, there's a scenario in which the Mets and the Braves both get it.
Yes. Yes. And right. If Arizona continues to struggle, and remember, Arizona has the Padres this weekend at home. And if the Padres keep winning, they absolutely will have everything to play for in those games. So
Arizona does not have any tiebreakers.
Yeah.
So if they finish tied with the Mets or the Braves, they get bounced.
Yeah. So snakes are, remember, they were kicking the Brewers' ass for the first three of those games. And then they choked that 8-0 lead. And now they're just getting their ass whipped by the Giants at home. So weird times for Arizona. Their pitching staff certainly struggling. And then I guess the last thing we just have to mention here, I don't want to linger on it, but we could have some unfortunate weather situations. There is a hurricane heading towards Florida. Which is the last thing you want to hear. Yeah.
Jordan Schusterman, weather report. Yeah. Weather report.
Again, this isn't really my thing. I'm just looking at normally I'm not Mike Trout storm tracking here, but Trout's probably on top of this. He's probably keeping an eye on this pretty closely here. I don't know if this is going to make its way. Tropical Storm Helene, not Helene, Helene. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. H-E-L-E-N-E. I think it has been upgraded to a hurricane. Either way, it is scheduled to basically hit, the Gulf Coast of Florida on tomorrow night, but the rains are already on their way. And so it seems like they have a decent chance of playing tonight. But if they get banged tomorrow, we'll deal with this on Friday. But the point is we could be talking about some very complicated Monday scenarios even by Friday. So I'm just throwing it out there. And on that lovely note, we will take a quick break. And when we return, we'll hit some of the other Tuesday action as well as some other news from around.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Enough about the National League. Let's talk about Al.
Yes. Al was busy yesterday, as Al often is. Let's start with the afternoon game. The Tigers win again, folks. You can't stop this team. Tarek Skubal goes out on a cloudy afternoon in Detroit, Michigan, and tells the Rays, I'm going to win Cy Young. And this is what it looks like. He was fantastic. The Tigers put a couple runs on the board, and that is enough for this unstoppable Tigers pitching staff led by Tarek Skubal, who had his Cy Young moment there. And now the Tigers are in good shape. I don't know what their playoff odds are up to. I think they're now like over 70 or almost 80%.
What a world.
Now in the standings, they are still tied with Kansas City. Kansas City finally winning. Kansas City barely winning. They don't, again, we talk about how horrible their offense has been. They get shut out in the first 9 innings in DC, and they can only score the automatic runner.
It was as close as you can get to losing a game that you won. I understand that at this point in the season, dubs are dubs, but getting shut out by the Washington Nationals for 9 innings in that spot.
But that's what the Royals offense has been. And they literally needed to be handed a runner in scoring position and barely scored that one and then hung on at the very end. Ursic closes it out. So they snap their 7-game losing streak. They now have the same record as the Tigers.
They only scored that automatic runner because Nats shortstop Nassim Nunez yeeted a ball, like couldn't get it out of his glove, again, and they scored on a bad throw.
Like this team's struggling to score. Let's be charitable. Let's do a mitzvah. The Twins, meanwhile, we talked about kind of setting up this final week about how all these teams in the mix have one more bad team on the schedule, with the Royals playing the Nats, the Tigers playing the White Sox this weekend, and then the Twins playing the Marlins at home. And the Twins did not get the memo that these were the games you absolutely had to win, as they drop one against Miami at home. And it was a pretty lifeless performance. The crowd was pretty uninspired, as they should be, because that's what the Twins have kind of given them over the last few weeks. And now the Twins are two back of their AL Central rival Tigers and Royals. I mean, it ain't looking good.
Fish are not folding. These Marlins, remember, this was a playoff team. Okay, they've got experience in important games. Skip Schumacher's boys are not rolling over.
This is when they're at their best. The last week of the season. Yeah.
Gets tough. Very brief word on the Marlins. Jonah Bride. How much have you been watching Jonah Bride?
This is a very me thing for you to do, is to bring up Jonah Bride during this last week of the season. But who am I to say that you shouldn't? So go ahead. I know about Jonah Bride. I don't think most people do. So I'm curious why you're bringing him up, though.
Well, he went yard yesterday, and that was kind of the deciding blow in this game, with the Marlins scoring early in the second inning.
Yeah,
Jonah Bride, this is it. He's 5'10". He's listed at 5'10", 200 pounds. I think that first number is high and that second number is low. And for a team to be playing Jonah Bride and Jake Berger at the same time is just a real... Like, the Marlins season has not gone to plan, but to go double barrel beefy boy right now deserves... Yeah, winning some games?
Yeah.
Good job, boys.
He's had a nice season. That's an above average hitter for the Miami Marlins, which...
A lot of teams... Would love to have Jonah Bride.
Yes, he is also extremely like Peter Bendix coded.
Yeah, he is.
He is. Jonah Bride. Get him from the A's. Oh, undervalued, bad. Ooh, ooh, he's got the... It's great. Anyway,
good. Does he have Jonah a position? Bride. Who needs it? The Twins' performance last night was so utterly limp and lifeless and sad and wet blanket that I just brought up Jonah Bride. Okay. Yes.
But again, let's talk about the path forward for these three teams, right? So Tigers are keep playing the Rays, the Royals still got the Nats. I mean, this weekend, like, what's the hope for Minnesota? The hope for Minnesota is that the Orioles are not playing for anything this weekend. That's the hope, right? That's the goal. But even still, the Orioles B team playing well is probably going to whoop this version of the Twins. So that's really their challenge. But that's the road ahead, because these are the games they're supposed to be taking care of. And while Baltimore might not have anything to play for, although if they keep beating the Yankees, they might, that's what we're really talking about.
So watching some of the Rays-Tigers game yesterday filled me with a very special feeling. The last couple of years, the postseason series that I have been fortunate enough to cover have not been that cold. They have been warm. Even in Philly, last couple of years, it hasn't been too bad. And besides that, I have been lucky enough to take trips to San Diego, Phoenix, Dallas, and Houston. And watching that Tigers game and them panning to the crowd and seeing people in thick jackets already, that is what postseason baseball is all about.
I'm glad you said that, because the weather has been beautiful here in Northeast Ohio for a few weeks, but I hope it's cold for the DS. I don't hope it's miserable, but I hope it's cold. I hope it's 48 degrees. You know, this I don't want it to be 30, but like it should be cold when we're playing in the postseason. And we have not had that at all recently.
And that's the problem with global warming. And I've been saying that.
It's the number one issue.
Easily the number one issue with global warming. Not enough people are talking about it.
Yeah. Postseason.
Jordan, this is
hot.
How I know that you and I have moved up in the baseball media world. Because once upon a time, we would have been relegated to the auxiliary press box, which is usually outside. The coldest I think I've ever been was with you at the auxiliary press box in Boston during the World Series.
Oh, the Boston. Yeah, Chicago also. Yeah.
Brutal.
That was
cold. Not complaining about getting to go.
No complaints. It is,
now I think we might get inside.
Yeah, it's true. The press box in Cleveland, here's the X factor, key to watch here, even though literally nobody cares, but since you brought it up. Press box in Cleveland, gigantic. One of the biggest press boxes in baseball, like inexplicably. Also, freezing. The AC has been, the press box has been colder inside than outside recently. We'll see if that holds up in the postseason. Storyline to watch that nobody cares about. A couple other AL things quickly before we take another break.
Let's kill off the Mariners.
Yes. So the Mariners are now, they lose yesterday. Now, this was not a lifeless performance, but it was a frustrating one, but one that has happened so many times in Houston over the years, even though they have certainly played Houston better this season. Jason Hayward is an Astros thing I'm very interested to ask around about when the Astros are in Cleveland this weekend.
Can I say
a big
sentence?
Home run? Yeah.
Can I say a sentence? With Ben Gamble going down, Jason Hayward becomes a really important piece for the 2024 Astros.
It's true. Yordan is hurt, but they have other good players. What a surprise. The Astros win the American League West for the seventh time in the last 8 years. Yes, this team was abysmal in April. Yes, the Mariners were 10 games up in June, but here we are again. The Astros make it happen, and that's what they do. And we will be talking plenty more about Houston. I have no doubt about that. As for the Mariners, are they dead? Probably. I mean, I've been saying they've been dead for a while. They are two back of Kansas City and Detroit. Their best hope is Kansas City choking it. Their best hope is winning today, this afternoon, against a likely somewhat hangover lineup with Houston. It is George Kirby against Yusei Kikuchi, and then going home and beating the A's and hoping that Kansas City loses to a Braves team that will obviously be highly motivated this weekend. That is the path. It is not impossible. And obviously the Twins keep losing. It's not impossible. Obviously the playoff odds are still down to 3% or whatever. When you describe it, it doesn't sound that impossible. I still imagine they will somehow get eliminated on the final day of the season. I think we're heading towards a Joey Wendell-esque elimination as it happened in 2016. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you can go back and look at those games. But yeah, so, you know, tough. Sucks, whatever. I mean, I don't really know what else to say. They're still technically alive, but it ain't looking great. So that's the Mariners. And then the Guardians clinched a bye last night by beating the Reds. So that is the important thing. There was maybe a scenario where if they lost to Cincinnati this week and Houston kept winning, that Houston would have a chance to pass them this weekend. That is now off the table. So Cleveland, who is now a game and a half or two games back with the tiebreaker of New York, will continue probably to try to chase the one seed, or maybe they will rest some guys this weekend against Houston. We will see what that ends up being. So good for Cleveland.
Orioles-Yanks, I was there last night. The Yanks had a chance to win the division. If they had won last night, they would have clinched it. If they win tonight or tomorrow, they will clinch it.
Yeah.
The Orioles clinched with a win and a Twins loss, which is really, you know, you can really bank on the latter of those two things nowadays.
That's what happened.
But it was good getting to see the Birds. I hadn't really seen the O's for a couple months now, and a couple things about them really, I've begun to understand their slide a little bit more. I think them getting Ramon Urias, Ryan Mountcastle, and Jordan Westberg back, all three of whom are right-handed hitters, is a big deal. When Mountcastle went down on August 22nd, okay, from then until yesterday when he came back, they had a 295 slugging percentage against left-handed pitching. Because
that's
they were
a long
hitting
time. That's a month of slugging of like a
being horrible.
Yeah.
And that's because they were hitting Emmanuel Rivera, Eloy Jimenez, and Levon Soto in those guys' place. It's not rocket science sometimes.
Yep.
Orioles win that game. Dean Kremer, heroic performance. The only blemish, a bomb from Aaron Judge. Gleyber Torres had a hilarious base running kerfuffle that kind of stunted a Yankees rally. And the O's clinch a playoff spot. Congratulations to them. I was in the champagne celebration. I it was easily the driest I've been emerging from reporting on one of those. And that was really lovely for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't even have to shower when I got home. And that's nice. Is a big fat W. Yeah.
Aaron Judge homered again. It's probably just mentioned.
I just said that.
Oh, okay. 56 home runs, a lot of home runs.
I said the only blemish on Dean Kramer's line was Aaron Judge obliterating baseball.
Again, I just feel like, you know, it's like, oh, they're not talking about Judge enough. No. 56 home runs, a lot.
He's a good ball player, man.
Yeah, he's got a future in this league. That is the American League. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we will hit on a few other pieces of news before we say goodbye. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
Welcome back to the end of this show. Before we talk about Jackson Jobe, very quickly, Jackson Holliday as a character in the Orioles celebration last night was so funny. The Orioles had a little fake bird bath set up with some baby bottles, and then what I assume was like Martinelli's champagne, because again, Jackson Holliday is 20.
Yeah.
And I did not think he was in the room for a lot of the spraying. I did not see him in there because he cannot drink.
Unfortunately, the Brewers beat the Orioles to this with this similar joke, although I believe they had like non-alcoholic beer. Very popular now, by the way. I don't know if you're familiar. NA beer is on the rise. So they had a very similar setup in the Brewers celebration, but no, I mean, it's still hilarious. Now, Jackson Jobe, should the Tigers clinch a postseason spot here in the coming days? He's 22. Booze it up,
baby.
He can
have a brew.
I don't know what Jackson Jobe's drinking habits are. There's also, by the way, a very real scenario where the Tigers clinch a postseason spot before Jackson Jobe even appears in a game. So Jackson Jobe, arguably the top pitching prospect in baseball. I mean, I think pretty strong case as the top pitching prospect in baseball. The third overall pick in the 2021 draft out of an Oklahoma high school. The son of Brant Jobe, a professional golfer who once finished in the top 20 in the Masters. Seems pretty good. I don't know if he's
unrelated,
still golfing. But yeah.
Unrelated to
Frank.
Frank Jobe.
Yes, I believe.
Who
hopefully not.
Pioneered Tommy John.
Yeah. Probably better to be related to the golfer. But yeah, I mean, this dude is really freaking nasty. The reason they're calling him up is, I guess, they are, I would say, as good as their pitching staff has been, I think there is still room for upside in terms of just like raw stuff. You know, they have some of these guys that are getting outs, with all due respect to Sean Gunther and Brendan Hanafee and Bo Brisky. They're getting outs for sure. But this is a classic like, oh, this guy has, you know, 2++ pitches. And if we can unleash that in one inning in the right spot, that could be useful to us.
I mean, he had a 1.95 ERA in 73 innings with more than a strikeout per in the minors this year. Like
in double A, yes. So he had a couple triple A starts that weren't as smooth. But again, the arm talent here is undeniable. This is someone who his high school, it was kind of an interesting development just because his summer before his senior year was COVID, right? So 2020, summer of 2020 was kind of
coronavirus.
Yes, sorry, coronavirus, 19.
The coronavirus.
But it was in 20, just to be clear. I know sometimes there's confusion about that. But that showcase summer was a little strange, but it was very apparent when he was mostly a shortstop, but once he got on the mound full time, I was like, oh my God, stop hitting. You have all the ingredients to be an unbelievable starting pitching prospect. And the Tigers, from what I recall following that draft, the Tigers were just on this guy from like very early on. They were like, this is our dude. All the way until draft day, they committed to him. And, it wasn't necessarily the smoothest start. He was very good, you know, his debut year in 2022, but it was still like, this is going to take a while. This is a high school right-hander, long way to go. But generally, and he's had some health issues too, but when he's been healthy, he's ridiculous. So he'll be throwing triple digits, one of the best sliders you'll ever see. And I don't know where they're going to use him. Very curious what that first spot's going to be, as they are still playing must-win games here. But I'm excited to see what this looks like, especially if he is actually on this postseason roster.
Whole thing smells a whole lot like David Price in 2008, if you ask me. I'm excited to see what Jackson Jobe can do. Another Jackson. That's all we need in this world of baseball. Two more things. Number one, we got to say goodbye to Charlie Blackman. Chuck Nasty, the bearded legend in Colorado, is calling it a career. He will hang up the spikes next week. I like the timing on this. Give yourself a chance to say goodbye. Yeah. But you don't need to do a David Ortiz tour.
No.
What a career.
Do it. Set it up before the last homestand is perfect. They're playing the Cardinals this week. Nolan Arenado was there at his press conference, which was very cool. What a career, man. I mean, this is 14 years. This is a guy in one place. And I think he is so important because, I mean, he is maybe not at peak, but on volume, he's the second greatest Rocky ever. I don't really feel bad about saying that. He'll be a Rockies Hall of Famer. The fact that he loved being a Rocky in such a real way, a guy, you know, from the Southeast, but clearly very much, honestly, in some similar ways to Helton, right? Helton, who was a Tennessee born and raised, Charlie Blackman, who kind of grew up in Georgia, went to Georgia Tech. He was a pitcher a lot as an amateur, and then he eventually becomes an outfielder. And I mean, this is here's the best thing about it is you could say, oh, well, he played 14 years in Coors. Like, of course, he had put up all these ridiculous numbers. And the thing is, yes, that's true. Charlie Blackman took advantage of Coors Field as anyone with his talent should. And when you look at the bulk of his career, like, Here's a basic stat that really sums it up. You could be like, oh, Coors Field Merchant. It's like, yeah, but guess what? You put great hitters in Coors Field, they're going to do great things. Highest home OPS among all active players. Number one, Aaron Judge. Number two, Mike Trout. Number three, Bryce Harper. Number four, Mookie Betts. Number five, Charlie Blackman.
Amazing.
Okay? And that's over almost 3,500 plate appearances. He's like, yeah, I'm in Coors. I'm going to freaking enjoy it. And he made the most of it. He's a beloved figure there. Someone we've interacted with. He's outstanding. And I will miss watching Charlie Blackman.
He is seventh in franchise history in WAR. However, he is second in games played, plate appearances, hits, at-bats. And the reason that that's important within the context of the Rockies is that Charlie Blackman has always been there. And besides Todd Helton, that was not always the case. Trevor Story left. Nolan Arenado is gone.
Larry Walker.
Larry Walker in and out. Mm-hmm. Even Carlos Gonzalez, who...
Tulo.
Just the best.
Yeah, Carlos Gonzalez, right. Yeah.
But like, I know he's had an extension and just kind of got old quick. Charlie Blackman was just a constant, right? And just a great run in a place. And I say this all the time, but to be in a town and to mean something to the people who live there and watch you play and to become a part of a community, that is in a lot of ways more important than your WAR total.
Yeah. Or your team's record, right? You know?
Right.
We can continue to criticize the Rockies and how they've handled things and whatever. But hey, Charlie Blackman did play in the postseason a few times, you know, like they did. He's been in the postseason two more times more recently than some other players that we don't have to name. Yeah. So it is a really cool thing. Yeah.
Last thing here. The beard. It is a first ballot baseball beard to develop an aesthetic as a ball player that stands out as unique. Is very difficult to do, right? It is difficult to do, and it's even more difficult to do in a way that is genuine, right? That comes across as authentic. And Charlie Blackman being this, you know, hirsute, disheveled, bearded boy just came across so perfectly as a guy who you could imagine coming back from a hike in Boulder to go straight to the ball yard.
Yeah.
And I think without Charlie Blackman, there is no Brandon Marsh. Okay.
I mean, I will say it's a great question. I actually would love some email responses. Most iconic baseball beards of the 21st century.
Like, were there ball players, correct me if I'm wrong, were there ball players who looked like Charlie Blackman before this? Like, were there dudes in 1997 who were rocking this?
So that is a good point, because we always say, like, oh, the Yankees, they didn't let people grow their hair out. Like, honestly, there were a lot of other teams that probably were not cool with people having their hair like this for a long time. And that's a great question.
Like, Brian Wilson had a similar kind
Brian of vibe, Wilson is a very good one.
Dying his in a way that made it feel kind of contrived.
That's true. But regardless of the authenticity, that's definitely a good one. Producer Hart's putting Jason Wirth and Johnny Damon. Johnny Damon, in terms of like the longer hair, yeah, those are decent. Wirth is similar.
Johnny Damon his hair was almost like too straight, and the beard was not
the slightly long different enough. Look. And also, like, yes, Charlie Blackman has long hair, but let's stay focused on the face, right? Because that I still think is the focus here. So I would love some more baseball beard nominations.
I think this has a lot to do with the rise of the goatee in the 90s. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking about like Jack Bagwell as like a, and like then the Sal Fasano Fu Manchu, sure. Right? The 90s had a lot of that kind of thing.
Yeah. So anyway, let's hear about your baseball beards. All right, last topic before we say goodbye. The Oakland A's.
Between now and the next time we speak with you, the Oakland A's will have played their final home game in the city of Oakland. We have talked at length about this. It is a shame. It is an embarrassment. John Fisher, the owner of this club, should be ashamed of how he has handled this entire thing. And my heart goes out to all of the A's fans who care about this team. I would read Mark Carrig over at The Athletic. He wrote a really lovely piece about it. And baseball is what it means to people. But specifically, you wanted to talk about John Fisher's statement that was released this week.
Yeah, I mean, this is, we've heard so little from John Fisher, and this still counts as not hearing very much because this is a statement. The number of times he has stood in front of cameras, or let alone reporters, and said anything is just stunningly low, but also is kind of shines some light into how little accountability you have to take when you are in charge and when you are one of these 30 owners who are in charge of the team. But this statement, there are many insulting parts about it. It is a glimmer, a last gasp of a modicum of shame from John Fisher. You could think that he's like, I have to say something now.
You don't.
And well, right. But it's too late. You've missed infinite opportunities to do that. And which is why I'm not even going to necessarily comment on the substance of the statement, of which there's many things that can be refuted and are insulting things about being like, I wish I could talk to all of you personally, and we tried and all these things. Not only is this too little too late, it's missing the point once again. But I do think that it is a reminder that, like, yes, he still feels like, man, like, people really hate me. Maybe I can salvage some of this by putting this heartfelt statement. It's like, no, you can't. And this is one last kind of, you know, swift kick for this fan base. But hey, these last few games are going to be really cool there. Doesn't make it any better. They walked off last night. It reminded me of the really dramatic win they had last year when they won 7 in a row, their 7th win coming on the reverse boycott night. Well, it was absolutely packed there. And as we approach postseason baseball, I never got to experience it in person, but even watching it on TV, this was a baseball atmosphere, let alone the impact on the community and everything, but a baseball atmosphere that I will miss watching. And obviously that means so much more to the people who actually experience it and make that you know, community possible. So we'll see what the scenes look like on Thursday, but I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit on Friday, but obviously wanted to acknowledge that in some form.
So John Fisher very quickly made all of his money because his dad started The Gap.
Yeah.
How many pieces of Gap clothing are in John Fisher's wardrobe at his various homes? Just a thought.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so you could see a lot of responses to this, including from Trevor May, who closed out that seventh win in a row last year. And Trevor's been very outspoken about his perspective as someone who was playing for that team last year, right? And
yeah,
that is, there's a lot of people that this is impacting, and we will continue to kind of highlight those stories as best we can. All right, that's it. We did a podcast. You will be, I guess we'll both be back at the yard this week or today, I believe. We'll see.
Yeah, I'm on call, baby. The Yanks could clinch at any moment.
The Yanks are trying to wrap this division up. I think it'll be like with where the Mariners won that first game against Houston, and then, you know, Houston took care of business the next day. I feel like the Yankees will probably do the same thing tonight, but we will see. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz for producing as always. And we will talk to you all on Friday. How many teams will be clinched by then? Stay tuned.
30.